Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. I am Zachary Morphine, member of the LGBT Forum of the Commonwealth Club, and your moderator for tonight's program. Tonight, the Commonwealth Club of California is delighted to present Aaron Peskin, chairman of the San Francisco Democratic County Central Committee and the former president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, Laura Spangen, assistant general manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, an elected member of the Democratic County Central Committee, and a member of the Board of Equality California, as well as Andrea Shorter, campaign director for End a Marriage for All and the coalition coordinator for Equality California. The panelists will present their ideas and answer questions about the status of the marriage movement in California and what future steps they see as necessary to achieve marriage equality. Please welcome tonight's panelists. Aaron, would you like to begin?
Thank you, Zach, and thank you all for coming. And I'd just like to recognize an elected member of our extended city family, College Board of Trustees member Chris Jackson, who's in the audience this evening. I've always heard in the legal community a saying that goes, as goes California, so goes the nation. And I've been remarkably proud in my short involvement in political life in San Francisco to have a slightly different motto, which is, as goes San Francisco, so goes California, and so goes the nation. And indeed, we've seen that around any number of issues, the only minimum wage locally in the United States of America, a health care program that has become the talk of the state of California and the United States government, and we are now seeing discussed actively in the United States Congress. But relative to same-sex marriage, that has not been the case. As a matter of fact, California, with a very robust LGBT community, is behind the states of Iowa and Massachusetts and the United States as a whole, behind many countries on the globe. And I would like to think that San Francisco, with its grassroots model of organizing in the era where that has proven remarkably successful, that has gotten us a new president of the United States of America, that has repudiated the conservative policies of the Republican Party, can be a leader therein. And as a straight person, as a former supervisor and now head of the Democratic Party, we have tried to employ some of the grassroots techniques. The last year or two have been the years of Harvey Milk, and he has been celebrated now in a Hollywood film, celebrated most recently with presidential honor. And if you look back not at the film that was produced in Hollywood recently, but at the original documentary, there is human-to-human contact, one-on-one contact, that starts to sway and change the minds of not the people whose minds are made, but the people who are in the middle. And indeed, there are many San Franciscans because Prop 8 won here by 72%, which was not enough. And San Francisco had the resources but did not export them as widely as it could have to have those person-to-person contacts in Fresno and in Eureka and even in the county of Los Angeles to the south of us. And so we have been trying with a campaign that was started by one of our members one of the people who has been doing this every day is in the audience, and I want to celebrate him. Hello, Mario. Thank you for coming. We've been trying to use and employ that model, and thus far in what is called a canvas, we have actually raised little bits of money from 8,000 individuals in San Francisco, and we've raised a total of $235,000. Now, much of that has been spent on the program itself, but the notion here is that we can build an army, a cadre of grassroots volunteers for a campaign, whether it's in 2010 or 2012, and export San Francisco's know-how that we've used in endless number of local elections around the state of California so that we can join the states of Iowa and Massachusetts and indeed make the prophecy that as goes San Francisco, so goes the state of California and the nation.
Thank you, Aaron. Laura, please.
Thank you very much. President Peskin, I sit on the San Francisco Democratic Party with President Peskin, and I'm so proud that after No on 8 or Yes on 8 won in last November, there was such an outrage from members of my community, the LGBT community, and there was so much pain and sadness and disbelief and shock that I think it took many of us who were very active in that campaign to kind of realize what happened and kind of get back on our feet and keep fighting. And what was wonderful, particularly at the San Francisco Democratic Party, is that many of our straight allies decided to immediately take action and start what President Peskin said was a canvass through the San Francisco Democratic Party, and it literally started in December. So we have, you know, we hired people, we've been talking to people, raising money for the last 7 months, and it really is through the passion and spirit of many of our straight allies. And I just can't thank, you know, them enough, and I'm very proud of the San Francisco Democratic Party for doing that. You know, it's a it's an interesting time, I think, for the LGBT community. If you look at sort of the history of rights of different minority groups, different groups have sort of gotten equal rights at different points over the last 30 to 40 years. And if you look at the LGBT community, particularly at the federal level, we're really kind of at the end of the line. You know, at the federal level, we still don't even have a hate crimes law that protects us. We don't have housing or employment laws that protect us. And as I'm saying that, of course, today, many of you know, the Senate introduced for the first time an inclusive, an LGBT, transgender inclusive, non-discrimination and employment bill, which was, you know, which is amazing. But we still don't have those equal rights. We still don't have equal rights in the military with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And clearly, we do not have marriage rights. And so this is a critical time. I think the community, you know, is asking ourselves, what is the issue? What is it that still bothers people about gay people? You know, what is the underlying homophobia that's causing, you know, Congress to not even be able to pass a hate crimes bill or a non-discrimination and employment bill, or Californians to not allow us to continue to have the rights we had? I mean, remember, the LGBT community had marriage rights for 5 months. We were able to get married. And that still wasn't enough to convince the majority of Californians that it was an okay thing and it didn't bother anyone. And so now we have this protected class of 36,000 people, 18,000 couples that have this very unique status in the world. They're LGBT and they're married. So we have, you know, we have hope, as Harvey Milk said, you know, President Peskin conjured Harvey Milk, you know, you have to give him hope. And with President Obama, we do have hope. I think the LGBT community has had, you know, in his first 6 months, some issues with some of the things President Obama has done. But I absolutely think his heart is in the right place and that we just need to keep fighting. So our discussion, you know, tonight, I look forward to talking about how we continue that fight in a way that will actually allow us to have equal rights at the soonest possible time.
Thank you so much. Andrea, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I have a few comments. First of all, I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for this opportunity to engage the community and talk about the future of the LGBT movement and community, and I'm particularly honored to be here along with Aaron Peskin and Laura Spangen. And I think I have to also out myself as a Democrat as well, and in fact am the former officer of the LGBT caucus of the State Democratic Party. So I've been very involved for a number of years in terms of the developments of issues for our community there. I'm also very glad that the Democratic Party is has taken such a resounding stance as we move forward. I had the benefit of being at the last convention for the state party in April, along with some other colleagues that are fighting for marriage equality. And amidst all of the challenges regarding the budget and various measures that were on the floor that were being debated quite vigorously, I'm especially glad that we were able to walk out of that convention with a very unanimous and no-challenged issue around moving forward on marriage equality. So I'm very glad of that. Both of my friends here and colleagues have talked about various aspects of where we are today. I'd like to talk a little bit more about what it's going to take to win not only on within our community, but also what it's going to take in terms of building a better sense of coalition in California. As we all know, California is, we all love the uniqueness of California in terms of its vastness, in terms of its demographics, in terms of its diversity. While we are certainly sitting with some celebration, but certainly in some agony as we watch other states move forward, Iowa, you know, people were thinking, are still thinking, Iowa. How could it have happened in Iowa before it happens in California? The fact remains that certainly those processes by which marriage equality has been won have been somewhat different than in California. We have a very incredible history, for better or worse, with our referendum process that certainly I know everyone in this room has likely had some experience as advocates and defeating, not only trying to work to defeat measures like Proposition 8, but other measures as well that in the end don't treat us all equally. But California is truly a great state of diversity. What are we? We have been, even now, I think, with $26 billion somewhat in debt, we still remain one of the top economies of the world. We're our own country in many respects. So it is a very different climate, so to speak, than in a Maine or a New Hampshire or a Massachusetts and certainly in Iowa. We have hundreds of languages that are spoken. And when we talk about reaching out beyond the LGBT community, and reaching out to, for instance, communities of color, clearly one of the more significant debates in the aftermath of the passage of Proposition 8 was around the issues of the African-American community vote and what that meant in terms of the passage of Proposition 8, and I want to talk about that a little bit more later. But in terms of reaching out to communities of color, in the state of California, we're talking about reaching out to the state of California. The state of California is a majority-minority state. So the venture of reaching out, building coalition and community takes on a bit of a different dimension than it might elsewhere. It's not to say that other states, other communities don't have diversity. I don't want anyone to think that I'm painting them in the wrong respect. But nonetheless, I don't think that you can necessarily compare it to what we have in California. So as we move forward and try to do some of that exporting of experience and wisdom that Aaron had talked about earlier, in terms of what do we do to have boots on the ground, do the door-to-door work, to do the canvassing, and start telling our stories and engaging people to win back marriage, it's important that I think that we keep in mind that we're going to have to try some different ways in terms of involving the broader communities of color in the state of California.
Thank you so much, Andrea. So I'd like to discuss more of the concrete specifics about what's happening on the ground right now, pertaining to the Born Equal campaign under the Democratic Party and Equality California. So I would ask the panelists to discuss what the ground efforts that are being pursued by the Born Equal campaign and Equality California, and how do those efforts reflect a broader strategy of those campaigns. Aaron.
I should really ask Mauricio to come up here and tell everybody, because he does it every day. And we have how many, 12 people doing this now? We have 12 people who are canvassers who go out on shifts all day long all over San Francisco, and they stop and engage people. And it is remarkable because I actually get emails of the credit card receipts, and some of them are San Franciscans and some of them are tourists who have been stopped on the street. And when I go down to the Democratic Party headquarters and I talk to these individuals, most of whom are straight, all of whom are young, they have remarkable stories that defy the demographic. The elderly woman stories of Republicans who are contributing to the effort and absolutely do not want their name and their email address ever to be used for a Democratic issue, but are interested in this issue and are interested in volunteering. And we're trying to expand that into house parties. We're trying to get people engaged in a way that, like with the Barack Obama campaign, when we opened our campaign headquarters at 939 Market Street, we had hundreds of people who flowed in who we did not recruit, and we sent them to New Mexico and to Reno and to Las Vegas. We are trying to find and cultivate and train that army of people who can do one-to-one contact. And the drudgery of it, and let's be honest about it. It's kind of miserable to stand on a street corner. I know that because when you run for office, you stand on a street corner and you say, "Hi, my name is Aaron Peskin. You don't know me. I'm running for the city council. And let me tell you about who I am. And would you vote for me?" And that's the contacts that these people are doing. They've now done it. They've had more than 8,000 contacts. They've had 8,000 individuals who have either written them a check, given them cash, or given them their credit card number. And we have learned to get sophisticated enough to actually process their credit card numbers and follow up on bad credit card numbers. And that has raised $235,000 less what we've had to pay these people. And we're doing it the San Francisco way. We're doing health benefits and paid holidays and the whole bit. But it has now become a self-sustaining organization. When we started this, and Michael Bornstein came up with the idea, and it was December, and we were all very happy that we had a new president of the United States and a progressive board of supervisors and had passed two only in San Francisco progressive tax measures. We were all remarkably bummed out about the passage of Proposition 8, and we put up $5,000, and we told Michael, everybody thinks the Democratic Party in San Francisco is rich. Let me tell you, I think we have $25,000 to our name. And Michael came up with this idea, and we said, when you exceed $5,000, we're done. It has turned out to be a self-sustaining operation. And beyond the money, we are capturing people's names, their interests, their imagination, their hearts, their soul, and training them to become involved. And it's really kind of a very hard thing to do because we don't know what fight we're going into. We don't know, is it going to be on the ballot in November of 2010, 2012? And we are very small little cogs in this larger discussion that's going on between numerous organizations. And then let me just say, relative to what Andrea Shorter was saying, this is the seminal civil rights issue of our time. And far be it for me to Monday morning quarterback Prop 8, but the imperative for us is to broaden the coalition. And if anything went wrong last November, it was the fact that it wasn't a, you know, Jew and a black person and a gay person working for civil rights in the South, right? And we've got to spread that word. And I think that is an ultimately doable task in the great state of California. And I think our state is diverse enough and smart enough and educated enough that with a little bit of one-on-one contact, if we can export this model, we will turn this back. And the individuals, the 12 smiling, hopeful faces who are involved in this will be able to say to their children or their grandchildren or their parents or their friends that they were involved in the great issue at the dawn of the 21st century that brought us into the new age.
Thank you so much, Aaron. You are listening to a radio program of the Commonwealth Club of California featuring Aaron Peskin, Laura Spangen, and Andrea Shorter. Laura, do you have anything you'd like to add on to that?
Sure, absolutely. I'm very lucky because I sit on the Equality California board, and I also am a member of the Democratic Party, both organizations that are doing very substantive canvas programs. And I'll let Andrea talk about the Equality California one, just as Aaron talked about the Democratic Party. Why I'm lucky is because the work that needs to be done is this work, is the communicating to people one-on-one. President Peskin was partially right that one of the reasons Proposition 8 lost was because we did not collaborate enough. We did not work with other groups enough. But the other reason it lost was because it did not have a very deep field campaign. And a field campaign is very hard in a state this large. It literally is knocking on doors and having very significant conversations with people who are uncomfortable with this topic, but who are wanting to talk about this topic. These discussions do not happen in 5 minutes. They do not happen on the phone. They happen face to face, and some of them take as long as 30 minutes. So when you look at the state and you look at the percentage of people we need to change and you multiply that by 30 minutes, that's a lot of time. So a poll was just recently done about a month ago to see if anyone has actually changed their mind on this issue. And there was a report today about a field poll saying that, you know, Californians are more supportive than they were the last generation. That's positive. But this poll was really looking at this issue, really looking at marriage equality. And what was interesting was that there was practically no movement from the November election. Practically no movement. The people that were against it were just as against it. The people that were for it were just as for marriage equality. And there was a very small percentage of undecideds. So what that tells us is that these conversations need to that the conversations we've had have been great, but we need to continue them. We need to continue them and continue them and continue them till we start to see some movement in the people that actually can be swayed from not supporting marriage rights to supporting marriage rights. And it just is just going to take more time.
I think that one of the things that we can't, building on that we can't underestimate in terms of the No on 8 effort was the context in which it occurred. It occurred during one of the most amazing, if not the most amazing, presidential races in U.S. history. And given that, there were so many things that occurred during the Obama campaign in particular. Obama really ran what I would call something of a hybrid campaign. It was certainly sort of top down, but had a very strong grassroots element and feeling to it. What they did was basically changed the standard. They set a new bar during the year 2008. And so a number of people, I think, had an expectation, certainly, that there should have been more, and I agree, more of a grassroots effort in the No on 8 campaign. But I also want to be fair. I think that really sort of the ground shook beneath us during that period of time, and the way in which campaigning was being done on that level. And again, it's not a completely fair analysis. It's not a completely fair comparison. You're talking about a presidential effort versus a statewide initiative. But clearly the outcry has been for more of a grassroots involvement moving forward. Why is that important? Clearly that's important as you relate it to the need for greater coalition building, not just on the issue of marriage equality, but on a number of civil rights issues that are not necessarily just specific to the LGBT community, but to a number of communities. The African American community, I think, continues to, in terms of what do we do, how do we further engage the African American community, continues to be a big part of the discussion. But I want to be very mindful about a couple of things on that point. One, as we move forward, let's make sure that we understand what the demographics are of the state of California. African Americans are not, by any stretch of the imagination, the majority of the populace, and certainly we're not the majority of the voting populace. But a lot was made in terms of what was initially reported as the voting patterns or behavior of the African American community coming out of the November election. And the report being that, you know, African Americans overwhelmingly had supported this measure to the tune of something of 70% and beyond, and only later to find out that, no, it was not around 70%. It was really around 57%, which didn't put it out of league or didn't make it a radically disproportionate measurement against other populations that had voted yes on A. But the perception is still very important. Why? Because as we move forward and talk about the issues of LGBT liberation and civil rights, by talking about what the African American community is doing, I think that our opponents, so to speak, they get something out of what I call a twofer out of that. By continuing to promote the idea that there is this wide division, this wide chasm between the African-American and LGBT communities, they're basically creating a political wedge. And they use the 70%, although it is not true, to do this. One, to say, well, if African-Americans are the vanguard, so to speak, of the civil rights movement, and if LGBT people are saying, this is a civil rights issue, and if those folks, if the Rush Limbaughs and the Bill O'Reillys and others can broadcast and say, but wait a minute, African-Americans, black folks have said this is not a civil rights issue. So LGBT people, step back. So they can use that particular figure as a tool, again, to sort of create that wedge. The other piece is what we haven't really talked about just yet, is on this issue of religion. Beyond race, beyond trying to forge the needed coalitions and build on the coalitions with communities of color, religion is really the primary issue, is the principal issue by which many people who voted for the passage of 8, that was a deciding factor for them. So the other point is by using the 70%, again, although false, can say, well, African Americans, as we know, have a high propensity of attendance at church. They are some of the most God-fearing, church-going members of society. And so therefore, if African Americans say no to marriage equality, this then is not a secular issue, although we're talking about civil marriage. So if they've said that this is not an issue that is about a secular or civil marriage and this is an issue about morality, et cetera, then LGBT people step back. So I think that paying attention to some of the perception and the use of that symbolism of who is involved and who is the vanguard and who can make claims on civil rights movement, we have to be very mindful of. We have an opportunity moving forward to build on the incredible legacy of a number of civil rights movements. But we also have an opportunity to really, I think, redefine and reshape progressive movement that is more inclusive of LGBT issues and people than we ever have before.
Laura, going back to what you were discussing about the amount of time that it will take to talk to people and the amount of grassroots organizing that's needed, do you think it's realistic to mount another initiative in 2010?
A very simple question. I think every LGBT organization and maybe every LGBT person in California is either thinking or talking about this right now. And there is no overwhelming consensus yet as to what is the right time. I will go through some of the arguments on both sides and sort of give you my assessment of it. First of all, there really sort of are four options, not really two. There's a few people that think we should go every year until we are able to win marriage equality. So every time there's an election that we can go on the ballot, 2010, 12, 14, et cetera, just keep going until we win. There's another camp that says don't even talk about a year. We have to combat homophobia. We have to see the numbers change before we can really decide when we're going. So we shouldn't discuss you know when. We should look at the numbers and decide then. Of course, then there's the 2010 camp, and then we need to go during the next presidential election in 2012. Those two are obviously the most hotly debated options, and I call one the passionate year, and I call one the factual year. Because when people talk about 2010, they are very passionate. I mean, when I think about it, I get passionate, right? I mean, LGBT people are still second-class citizens. We were able to get married just a few months ago, and voters stripped that away. And it seems unfair. It seems disgusting. It seems awful. How could we have a right taken away from us that we had? And so we want to get it back as soon as possible. We can't just sit on the sidelines and wait. We have momentum. We have tons of groups that were not involved last year are now involved. We have lots of more additional straight allies. You know, we've got so many people excited. They want to work. They want to do it now. 2010 is the year. And also having a deadline, a deadline that seems, you know, seems close, right? 2012 seems kind of far away, can't really visualize that. So if we have a deadline that's, you know, we can see and feel and, you know, think about, we're going to actually work hard and raise money. The 2012 side says, that's great. The momentum's wonderful, people, et cetera. But if you look at the numbers, it's going to be very difficult for us to win in 2010. If you look at the polling data that I just talked about recently, it's people have not moved. They're even more entrenched, actually, that the rallies and the, you know, marches and all of that are not moving people. What moves people are the conversations we're having door to door. They take a lot of time. What moves people are probably better messages than we had in the last election. We have to not only have better positive messages, we have to combat the messages of the other side. We have to stop letting them say that we are going to hurt children or corrupt children in the schools, which is what they did. We have to stop a lot of their arguments that are absolutely not true. And so we have to get better at that. And it just takes more time. It takes more thought, more strategy, more time. And we have to work better in coalition, as my panelists, the fellow panelists, have said. I mean, that also takes time. You don't just work with clergy and religious groups and other groups overnight. I mean, it takes time to have them understand our issues, keep talking, and have them talk to their constituencies. It's not just talking to the leaders of the organizations and the other coalitions. It's actually having them then understand these issues, believing in them, and then talking to the people that they have credibility with. And that takes time. So my personal feeling about it is that I'm sort of a hybrid, and I like numbers, but I'm also passionate about the topic. Mm-hmm. So what I would like are the communities that are very, very active on this right now to sit down and talk about some benchmarks that we need to reach to in the next few months and maybe in the next 6 months to see if we are ready to go in 2010. These benchmarks include more conversations at the door, money raised. You know, this is going to be, some people are saying the last campaign was a $40 million campaign. People are saying this is going to be a $60 million campaign. That means we need to raise $30 million in a very tough economy. So raising money, what is the right benchmark for the amount of money raised? And if they're and have the different groups that are so active right now, have them take responsibility for the things they're good at. Some groups are great fundraisers. Some groups are great at knocking on doors. Some groups are great at, you know, organizing people for rallies and marches. Have everybody take responsibility for the thing that they're good at. Have there be a benchmark for it. See if they can meet the targets. And then maybe we can go. There's also part of me that says, you know, these benchmarks maybe should just be for 2012 because they're probably going to be difficult to reach in 2010. But since there's so much momentum out there, maybe there is a way to reach some of these benchmarks and it would make 2010 more viable. So those are my thoughts.
Erin, you said earlier that we're just cogs in a larger discussion about the timing around these issues. And I'm curious what you can say about how you envision the decision ultimately being made.
Well, I would like to add to my colleague Laura Spangen's four options, the fifth option, which is when you are in the soup of politics, you never know when other things in the landscape will change that create remarkable opportunities. And I see two of them in the state of California. We have the juxtaposition in the state of suffering under the tyranny of the majority, which is the hijacked referendum process, which originally was a process. Does anybody remember why it came about? It came about as an anti-corruption democratic tool to thwart the remarkable corrupt power of the railroads. That is how we end up with the referendum process in California. I used to talk to my colleagues in New York who were on the City Council of New York, and they thought we were just so crazy because we had referendums at the state and local level, and in order to raise taxes, we had to go to the ballot, and they just thought we were nuts. We also have in California juxtaposed is the tyranny of the minority, which is that a third of the legislature can block the budget. And these things, I think, may be coming to a head. And to the extent that John Burton and the State Democratic Party are starting to talk about the tyranny of the minority, and we are all starting to talk about the tyranny of the majority and the misuse of the referendum process where our state constitution can be changed through advertising and majority vote to take, for the first time in our state's history, rights away from people, maybe those things can coalesce where, whether it's in 2010 or 2012, when those things come to a head, perhaps we can slide this issue in shoulder to shoulder with it, and perhaps Californians will understand that there are seminal issues of civil rights and the ultimate governance of the state of California. And you also never know when other incredible things will happen. You never know when somebody will do something remarkably smart or remarkably stupid and it gives you an opportunity. I personally am adherent to the go again and again and again strategy, although I know that when you lose the second time, you know, as much bravado as you have, it knocks you back for an extra 4 years. And I know the same thing that we all know, which is that the mores of the people of the state of California are changing, and they have changed exponentially over a very short period of time. And actually, when I go to sleep at night, I know that it's not a question of if, it's a question of when, and we've just got to make sure to be at the right place at the right time, which is what 12 canvassers at the Democratic Party are preparing for. And when we first started, we told them this was going to be an 18-month campaign. Now we're telling them it might not be an 18-month campaign and that this may be what they're going to do for the next 2.5 years or 3.5 years of their life. It also blows my mind that in a state that has been remarkably blue, we continue to elect Republicans. In a state that elected Barack Obama by an overwhelming majority, we voted no on yes on Proposition 8 instead of no. How do we reconcile those things? How do we bring those things together? And I think the model of the Obama campaign that was both from the bottom up and the top down, and the model that we've employed remarkably successfully here in San Francisco, is potentially the model that helps us win the great state of California.
In terms of some of the issues that your campaigns are facing, can you discuss those? And what are you facing currently, and what are you anticipating down the road?
Well, Equality California has mounted a campaign called Winning Marriage Back, Making It Real. And we do have an army of field organizers and canvassers that are out there, and in fact have reported this past weekend that they've already knocked on the doors and had conversations with over 420,000 people. So we are on the move in terms of having those kinds of conversations and discussions that are necessary in terms of changing hearts and minds. And a lot of that effort, however, is concentrated by and large in Southern California. So I think it's really important that while we are very hopeful of exporting some of the know-how from San Francisco outside of our immediate area, really a lot of the work to be done is in Southern California. And I don't necessarily mean just in Los Angeles. Clearly in Los Angeles, we were very close. And I want us to be mindful, too, that there is a bit of a ray of hope here in that we only lost by about 4 points, a little over 4 points. So it's not as though we are vastly, we're 20 points behind. So polls are moving to some extent. They may not, as Laura said, be moving drastically. There's something of a standstill, but polls are moving. I know that in some communities of color, they've moved at least 5% our way over the last 6 to 7 years. So it is not just a question of if, as Aaron put it, but of when. So in Southern California, in the Inland Empire, in San Diego County, certainly Los Angeles, there's a great effort on our part to do a lot of that door knocking and a lot of working with people to have those conversations with their friends and family. I had a phone call one morning very early. I don't want to say how early because I don't want to encourage people to ever call me that early again in the morning, from a woman who was from Southern California. I believe she was somewhere near San Diego County. And she was nearly in tears. She was in tears because she was beginning to realize the impact of the passage of this proposition on her sister, who is lesbian and was set to marry her partner of many years. And she was nearly in tears because she realized, you know what, in this state where we have both grown up, we've both grown up as good Catholic girls. We've abided by the law. We've educated ourselves, so on and so forth. We had hardworking parents. The truth of the matter is that my sister is not legally equal to me. And her regret was that she did not have the conversations. She did not talk more about why this issue of marriage equality was important to her, to her friends and family and co-workers and her fellow worshipers. So the effort that we're embarking upon right now, I think that certainly within the next couple of years we will have talked to and reached out to millions of folks, either directly or indirectly, just by sparking those conversations that need to take place.
Andrea, can you continue to speak about some of the work that you've been doing directly within communities of color and how it's influenced your perspective and work in the marriage movement overall?
Absolutely. Again, as I said earlier, working to build coalition between the LGBT community and communities of color is clearly very important. But remember, there are also people like me that are both LGBT and people of color. So they're not necessarily exclusive entities by any stretch of the imagination. But as we've been on this particular journey, we should also bear in mind that we have had some very strong partners in our coalition. The California NAACP was one of the first organizations to step up and say, what can we do to help? What can we do to provide leadership, not only to be a partner in this coalition, but what can we do to lead? So the president of the California NAACP, Alice Huffman, has been just a stalwart friend and advocate in this particular movement. Along with our other partners from MALDEF, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, Chinese for Affirmative Action, and certainly those are organizations that have also played a critical role in the legal aspects of challenging the court or challenging the legitimacy of this particular proposition. But in my experience in the last couple of years, specifically working with the African American and Latino communities, is that one thing that we have to do differently is that there are many African American and Latino communities. It's not a one-size-fits-all kind of a message. There are certainly a number of African Americans that are, in fact, regular churchgoers, just the same as there are folks that are not. And I think that some of the messaging that was attempted may not have addressed the full complement, the full diversity of either of those particular communities. The API community, sort of the same thing, certainly. Various language issues is one example. So API organizations like Asian Pacific Islander, Islanders for Equality, has been a very key partner in trying to develop that particular the outreach that's needed to those communities around the state. But by and large, I think that for one of the things as we move forward in this movement that we're learning, and I think it was a good thing that came out of the passage of Proposition 8, was that what we learned as an LGBT community, or what we were hearing, were not people just asking us how can we help or what happened, but really demanding a place at the table, saying we are here in partnership and we're here to work with you and really lean on us a little bit more in terms of how to work more effectively in the variety of communities in California. So the effort that we're employing in Equality California is certainly to build on the coalitions and alliances that have existed and really listening more to the leadership, the community leadership. So I don't mean just organizational leadership. I also mean the moms, the grandmas, the aunties, the uncles, the folks sort of on a block-by-block basis. How do we talk to neighbors? Who can we go to in certain communities as elders and folks that will listen to? And certainly one last thing in terms of just sort of generational shifts. There is a generational shift that is not necessarily unique to communities of color, but a generational shift. We have many more young people, and that actually may be one of the benefits of going in 2012. We'll have more young people of color as well that will be eligible to vote. And as we well know from the Obama experience, as we will probably see moving forward in the gubernatorial races, the presence of those young voters will be vital to win or lose in either this race or this particular effort or others.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is only time for one more question, and I open this up to all of the panelists who would like to answer. Looking at the immediate future, what kind of work are you looking at, and What are you foreseeing immediately in the next few days, in the next few weeks? Laura, Aaron?
Go ahead, Aaron.
No, I'd just say the next few days and the next few weeks are going to look like the last few days and the last few weeks, and Mauricio and his colleagues are going to be out there, and the people who Andrea are going to works with are going to be out there. And it really, it's one of those things where if we can all get excited enough. I mean, I remember getting excited about various things and that buzz. I mean, I remember every time I felt depressed, I hit that little button on the computer and I sent Barack Obama another $100. Mm-hmm. And part of that, and I don't own a TV set, so I wasn't getting that on the TV. I felt it, and I felt it pretty early on. And how do we communicate that every day as part of what we do? We all have lives to live, and we have to eat, and we have to work, and we have families and what have you. How do we communicate that in every single way? I mean, whether it's sending out emails to folks, whether it's getting – I had somebody call me yesterday, Mauricio, you'll like this, who wants to come and volunteer on the canvas and not be paid however many dollars an hour you guys get, and he's coming your way. Whether it's finding those people because, you know, they're in the middle of college or they're done with high school, we've just got to find places to plug them in. And then I'll say, as a straight man from San Francisco in this absolutely LGBT-positive town, there was a sense of alienation even here for people like me that we have to break down. And if we can't break it down in San Francisco and we can't make people like me feel like they can do something, then we are bound to fail, whether it's in 2010 or 12 or 14. And we've got to make it remarkably welcoming so that you can feel – I mean, I remember growing up, somehow or another, my, you know, parents explained to us that we were not going to eat table grapes anymore. And how can we do that for this issue? And I know we can do it, and I know we can change public opinion about it, and it just requires a heck of a lot of hard work tomorrow and next week until we're done.
I agree with everything President Peskin said. I would add, it, you know, a lot of people are like, well, I can't go to Bakersfield. I can't go to Orange County. I know those are the places that need our help, but that's, you know, it's hard for me to do that. It takes a lot of time. You know what? We need to have conversations here in San Francisco. A lot of times people ask, why are you doing a canvas in San Francisco? Why is the San Francisco Democratic Party doing a canvas in San Francisco? You guys are fine. Everyone's supportive. You don't worry about it. It's not true. I mean, we should have had a higher no percentage in San Francisco. We also should have had a higher percentage of no votes from Democrats in general. If you look at the numbers, the majority of Democrats, you know, it was just a slight majority voted against Proposition 8. So having the San Francisco Democratic Party out there talking about marriage equality hopefully will help us have a higher percentage of Democrats voting for marriage rights. Other simple things you can do in the next few days: you can Facebook about marriage equality, you can Twitter, you can email, use electronic media. People are, you know, more and more people are using those mechanisms to talk about how they feel, to talk about, message about these issues. Go and do it. Say you thought about marriage equality today and you talked to your mom, or, you know, and talk to people. Just talk to people. I mean, there's a, you know, a stat out there. I don't know if it's true, but if we could, if, you know, every person knew 7 LGBT people, every single person would vote for marriage equality. So, yeah. So, you know, if you're LGBT, talk to someone who doesn't think they know an LGBT person. So we need to keep talking to each other and using simple mechanisms and more difficult mechanisms. And I encourage all of you to do that, because it will take all of us to actually win an election for marriage equality finally.
Thank you, Laura. A very special thanks to our panelists this evening for sharing their thoughts on the marriage equality movement in California. I would also like to thank our audience here and on radio for your attention this evening. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.